Okay, hello everybody. Welcome to the third annual Downtown Reading Old Timers Weekender. My name's Lucy and I'm an alcoholic. This group wishes no negative atmosphere, so please respect this. Phones on silent, no sweets or gum chewing, no texting and no electronic cigarettes. Just a bit about housekeeping. Smoking outside and the butts in the sand buckets, please. The fire exits at each end of the building. I feel like an air hostess. And can you gather together in the garden, please? The loos are out the rear door and to the right or opposite the rectory in the main house. And John has some books in the back with 50-year-old sober old-timer stories, if anyone wants to buy one. And finally, today's being recorded. So if you want a recording, please leave your email and address in the book in the back and we'll get back in touch with you whether you want it digitally or on a CD. Okay. Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I just want to mention quickly Sylvie. The next 2 days actually are happening due to a lady non-alcoholic whose passion and courage not to quit because it was raining. She taught us to dance in the rain. Sylvie came to the first Old Timers event believing that the pain she was in, she would not stay too long. We had to chase Sylvie out at the end of the day, and the same again last year. Sylvie is with us today, sat amongst us with Moira and the rest, sadly only in spirit, the love that never dies. If the chairs are empty, that is not what matters. It is our hearts filled with love and hope, whether it is AA or Al-Anon. Right, now I'm going to read how it works. If you're not bored with my voice already. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And that God could and would if he were sought. And then just finally before Miles shares for us, I'm going to say 26 names of those old timers who are no longer with us. Tom G, Walter, Jesse, Jimmy A, Ron G, MS John, SAS Angry John, Babs, Michael Kevin, Fireman Colin, Tall Mark, Taxi Gary, Wee Adam, Martin the Monk, Lockkeeper Joe, Young Maidenhead Mark, America John, Vera from Newbury, Melvin, Sheila from Bracknell, Eve of Henley, Barry of Wantage, Pat of Twyford, Guardsman John, Irish Archie, and Maura. These are just a few names, so many more are not mentioned. It is good to say that their message is still alive and living in meetings they started decades ago that carries the message to the still suffering alcoholic. This is AA today, sitting in an old tin hut, the urn is on, chatter in the kitchen, smokers no longer creating the smoke-filled rooms, thankfully, smokers outside, others sitting waiting for the meeting to start. Bill Wilson wrote in the AA Comes of Age, page 220, AA's claim any alcoholic who continuously works the AA program has a better than 3-to-1 chance of staying sober for their lifetime. Our old timers are living proof to Bill's testament, which Dennis is recording, copies of which will be available anytime. The cost of the event has been covered by members of Friday and Saturday Watlington House AA meetings. Please bear this in mind with Tradition 7 and fold your change into the pot. Our Old Timers Committee is very young in AA. Thomas is 4 years. James is 3 years. David has 4 years. Neil, 20 months. Big Tom, 6 years. Finally, I would like to introduce our first old-timer, Miles, from Brackley Thursday night. Is that your home group? Who has kindly joined us to kick off today's proceedings. Miles, who was the first old-timer you came across when you came into AA?
Sitting a couple of rows back, Mick.
Mick? Oh! And what was the first meeting you attended?
It was Beaconsfield.
Oh, right. Oh, brilliant. Okay. Well, I will hand over to you now to share with us your experience, strength, and hope.
You need to do this, otherwise it'll fall over.
Yeah. Can you lift it up?
Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
Excellent stuff. Thank you, first of all, for inviting me here today. It feels very strange to be sitting in a speaker's chair in something called an old-timers meeting. It's after my last drink when I got back to AA, because I've been around AA for a couple of years at that time. Talked to Mick a bit about cars, but didn't really talk to him anything about the program. Didn't really read the books, continued to get drunk. But after a couple of years, I was absolutely on my knees. And I used to have all of these ideas and fanciful notions that I wanted about life. But at that point, I had only one ambition. I just wanted to be an old timer in AA. I know we do it a day at a time, but that was the only goal I had. So apparently I have made it. And I can honestly say that sitting here with the Super K old timer doesn't feel any different to when I first came around AA. I still feel like a newcomer. I suppose we're asked to share a little bit about ourselves for the sake of identification, but I do understand that the topic for today is to talk about Reading, or my memories of Reading and what Reading was like and the people who were there. So I will try and incorporate that best I can. You might be able to tell that I'm not from Reading originally, and I come from Ireland, and my father was an alcoholic, and I don't know if that's got anything to do with me being an alcoholic. Don't really care. What's important to me is the fact that I know that I'm an alcoholic. But I do absolutely believe that growing up in an alcoholic household shaped the man I am today, and that to a large extent, dealing with a lot of that stuff is about finding myself comfortable in recovery. I didn't do much in the way of social drinking. I was never going to be a drinker. When my father was murdered, I took that first drink and my whole attitude towards booze changed. I never questioned that. I never thought to myself, that's strange. But from that point, my ship was cast upon the sea, and what comes next comes next. And I could have come to AA in my mid-teens, really. Drinking was a problem from the start, and my drinking was destructive, problematic, visibly problematic, not theoretically. I came to my first AA meeting at the age of 27. It was over at Beaconsfield, and I can remember the guy doing the chair. The only bit I can remember about his chair is he was celebrating that time in recovery when he had his first solid bowel movement. And maybe that says more about me than it does about him. I just find that fascinating. But I loved AA. I really got that I was home. You know, how can we not when we sit in a room full of our fellows? And I shared that I was an alcoholic, and I didn't drink for 6 months. I was going to 2 meetings a week. Those are the ones that Mick took me to my first meeting over at Beaconsfield, and he was going there, alternating that with Wantage. So that was my Tuesdays, and on Thursdays I'd go to Henley. But all I was doing was not drinking and use AA to stay off of drinking. And there were a lot of people floating around the place with, you know, they mentioned Pat early on. You know, I remember Pat from my first meetings over at Beaconsfield, and a lot of people knew a lot about how to live a sober life. All I really wanted to do was impress them with how wonderful I was. And, you know, they just kept saying, keep coming back. They didn't come and seek the wisdom that I obviously knew I had. One morning I woke up in a bed sitting in Reading. I'd never planned in my life to go to Reading or to be in Reading. And there I was. I was staying in one of those bed and breakfasts that are off the Oxford Road. And they're sort of, it's the anteroom to homelessness, really. And I woke up in the morning and I said, God help me, out loud. And, I'm an Irish Catholic, so I've got prayers for forever. All kinds of fancy prayers in my life, and retreats and spiritual this and that and the other. But this was the first genuine prayer in my life. It came right from my feet. And I knew I was doomed. I knew that AA wasn't going to work for me because I'd been around about 2.25 years at that time. You know, when you introduce yourselves to the meeting, say, every other meeting, my name is Miles, I'm an alcoholic, I've had a drink again, you know. But I knew that there was nowhere else I could be, you know, because I had lost connections that I had in the world, you know. The only name I had was Miles. There's some other people had other names for me as well. They weren't really very nice. But I belonged nowhere and with no one. But the first name I got a hold that I could have that was never taken away from me was that I could be a member of this fellowship. So I went along to the Wednesday night meeting around the back of the hospital, and it was in the geriatric day center. Smelt the biscuits, that room did. But it was a big room, and it was packed. There's usually like 40-odd people at that meeting. And I turned up, and, you know, I couldn't share from the floor anymore. My name's Miles. I'm an alcoholic. I've had a drink again because it just felt too low. And I was back at the meeting because there was nowhere else for me to be. I didn't believe I was going to get sober. I didn't believe long-term viable sobriety was an option for me. I'm sure you've heard a lot of us talk about that person at the beginning of chapter 5. You know, there are such unfortunates. I was one of those. And at the end of the meeting, Harry came over to see how it was. You know. And that's the thing about fellowship. People come over to see how you are. And he said, "How are you doing?" I said, "I've had a drink again." He said, "You know what to do." And, you know, it was a bit of me, I was very confused by that statement. And I sort of wanted to punch him because I obviously didn't know what to do. Now, I didn't know whether I'd got to my last drink. My last recollection of drinking was, I think it was the Battle Inn, that pub just near the hospital. Correct me if I'm wrong. Drinking with a lot of Irish labourers. And then I went into blackout for the rest of the night. Now, what had happened was I'd gone out to get some fish and chips about 7 o'clock. I'd been drinking from 10 in the morning, so I was completely trashed. I'm lying in the doorway trying to fight my face with some fish and chips. You know. And back to that thing about fellowship, Bernie down the back there was coming up the road with his new girlfriend at the time. And there's this mess lying in the doorway at the other side of the road. Now, most people in society will just walk on by, feel sorry for, go tut, 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 or whatever. So Bernie decided to impress Mary by saying, "Just wait here a second while I go and talk to that thing in the doorway over there." And I was just liquid man. I was a complete mess. I don't remember a thing about it. You know, just because it was in blackout didn't mean it didn't sink there, you know. Because there I am the next night at an AA meeting. And for the first time, you know, I didn't want to drink that day as well. That was another unusual thing about me. Because I always had these plans, you know, write to the bank manager, get a new job, you know, say sorry to these people, send flowers, pick myself up, dust myself off, start all over again. This time, I just didn't have any of that going on. And there was nowhere else for me to be but at an AA meeting. And I felt at the lowest point in my whole life. And I needed to be there because, you know, the barrier of arrogance that I built around myself isolated me from anything that was of value that would nurture me in this life. And I started going to meetings. And I remember I was down at the town signing on, because that's, you know, a lot of us, maybe a few of you know those bedsits off the Oxford Road personally. And maybe a few of you found yourself sitting down the dole office in the centre of the town trying to get some money because you'd drunk it all away and you needed something to make it work. And Walter waltzed in with another member of the fellowship who had just come around. And Walter was taking this person down to sign on so that they could start to put their life back together again. And it used to be like there was a sort of an entertainment session down in that old dole office, because people would start fighting, you know. We all had ringside seats. So I started going to meetings, and back then, the reading at the beginning from Lucy was talking about how we don't smoke in meetings anymore. There was a cottage industry in Reading smoking hams and fish at meetings. It was just unbelievable, especially the Thursday evening meeting above the church. You couldn't tell who was in the room with that smoking. Like, I personally remember having 2 cigarettes on the go, you know what I mean? It's like you're just raw and insane, so anything that'll take the edge off the feelings, whether it's coffee or sugar or cigarettes or, you know, girlfriends, was gratefully sought. So I started putting my hand up to wash ashtrays, because that's where service started in AA. And Railway, there was 2 Rays in Reading. There was Railway Ray, and a Railway Ray stopped working for the railways. And he went to work for the down at Aldermaston, and we tried to change his name to Gamma Ray, but I don't think it really stuck. But there was another Ray called Roma's Ray, and he was sharing at the meeting. And I think again, it was the Wednesday night meeting a few weeks later. And he talked about, I can't remember whether he had been drinking around AA for 6 years, and was at that time 8 years sober. He'd been drinking around AA for 8 years and was now 6 years sober. And I heard him say that, you know, and it lit a little flame inside me, because if he can do it after that amount of time of just, you know, it's only been just over 2 years for me, you know, so that little light of hope was born, you know. And I don't think we can endure as people without hope, you know. I don't think it's feasible. And I started to feel this energy inside me and this feeling and this connection with AA. And it was, you know, I was given another pink cloud, you know, and I needed it, you know, just to give me that kind of momentum. So, you know, we're doing the washing up, and the next thing to do is to stick your hand up for the teas and coffees and tidying away to the chairs. And, you know, I started putting my hand up to a lot of these things. And I moved out of the little bedsit, got an ordinary job. You know, Mick told me, he said, Miles, stop going for these high-flying jobs that you're going for, because you keep putting the work ahead of your recovery. You get all excited and get carried away. Don't go to meetings and you end up drunk. So for the first time in my life, I listened to somebody's advice. Thanks, Mick. I actually ended up earning more money doing that than I ever earned and all of the other stuff that went on before it, but that's a byproduct. And I remember on Tuesday night, I'd worked overtime at work, because like a lot of us come into the program with debts all over the place, you know. I remember Pat talking about the debts he had when he first came into it. So I wasn't in his league. But, you know, the four clearing banks didn't want my business, but they wanted me to pay the debts that I had at the time. So I was working overtime to try and get back on my feet. And I'd moved to an ordinary little room, and just behind the railway station, there was those three-story houses. There was a young couple who were renting out a room, and I moved in there. And it was lovely, and they were a lovely couple, and I had, my sort of first place in recovery, really. And I used to walk up the Basingstoke Road in the summer, you know, because I got sober in summer, which was, it's a great time. My memory of that summer is really, you know, sunshine everywhere. I was banned for my drinking, but I would walk across town and up to the meeting at Liebfrau Milch Road, Lieben Reed Road, and all the meetings were within walking distance. And that was, you know, I was so lucky to find myself in Reading, because there was meetings every day of the week, some days it was two, and I could walk to them all, you know. And there was a lot of people, and there's a lot of sobriety, and there's a lot of people around, you know, who were in around the 4 or 5 year mark. You know, I remember April was the secretary of the Monday night step meeting back then, you know, and you could tell people were tingling with the kind of excitement about recovery, and, you know, it energizes you and pulls you through. And I also noticed that the people who had anything worth sort of really holding on to, they all had at least 5 years in the door, you know. So I realized that where I was going was that far away. And that was the first time, like my idea of patience up to that point had been how long it takes that first drink to hit or that first drug to take effect. So I'm coming out of work, and I'm going to pick up teas and coffees to go down to the meeting. And I thought to myself, I was feeling a little bit of resentment, you know. Oh, I've got to dash straight over to the meeting. I'll be glad when I've done my 90 and 90, because then I'll have a bit of time to myself. And a little voice in my head said, you don't have to do the overtime. You know, and that was a complete change in perspective. I could leave out the overtime rather than leaving out the AA. And there's a woman called Joyce Ditzler, who was one of the founders of Clouds, was talking at one of the mini conventions, and she was being asked this, you know, the $24,000 question, what makes successful recovering alcoholic? And she laughed, because, you know, if she could answer that question, she would be very rich. But she said it was people who got to a meeting nearly every night in the first year of their recovery, in her experience, were the people who had the highest percentage chance of making long-term sustained recoveries. So I thought, I'll do that. And I'm walking along to the meeting, having resolved that dilemma about whether to work or whether to make teas and coffees for AA meetings. But I also felt kind of special, because I was making teas or coffees about 4 or 5 meetings in Reading. I was the most important person in Reading AA, obviously, because without me, half the meetings were gone, really. And I started to get into this program and to work through it. And I remember going out to see Mick for the first time in early days. And, you know, and I wanted Mick to tell me that it was going to be fine. I wanted him to say, you've got it, Miles. I can see by the look in your eye, by the cut of your jib, by the way that you hold yourself, it's all going to be just wonderful. He didn't, you know. He just said, Miles, you'll know yourself. And we started to work through the program. And you talked about Sylvie early on, and, you know, I can remember Sylvie from my very earliest days, you know, and that universal smile, you know. I never turned up at Mick's place and saw Sylvie any other smile, you know. And that was a strange thing, really, because I felt lower than a worm's belly. You know, I wasn't fit for decent human company, and here was this woman with two children smiling and welcoming me into the house and saying, would you want a cup of tea or, you know, a piece of cake? And, you know, it was just a beautiful thing. And, of course, Mick and Sylvie used to do the rock star stuff. They used to go around and do joint chairs together, telling all the people how to cope with the terrible illness of alcoholism to get well and shine their light upon us all. And we were all duly grateful. So, you know, but... You know, I became a member of AA at that point, you know, and AA had never said you can't be a member to me. It had never said you don't belong here. You've got to cross certain thresholds. You've got to achieve certain things to belong here. The door was just always open, you know. Another person that they talked about at the beginning, Walter, you know, because I think the Irish invented alcoholism. I think the Scottish perfected it. And I think the Americans found the cure. But, you know, I remember Walter... And when Walter was on form at a meeting, when he shared, you know, the pipeline straight to Bill W., it was just clarity and courage and strength. And it was one of the meetings, because I'm running around like a blue-assed fly. I think a lot of us do that in recovery. We get so busy trying to make everything right, you know. The only thing you need to do, really, is just concentrate on the program, give yourself enough space to get well. But, you know, people, places, and things have a lure, you know. In reality, I think it's just easier to go and deal with money than it is to deal with all that screwed up kind of emotion and twisted instinct stuff. And I fell asleep at one of the meetings, and I felt kind of ashamed. You know, I thought, God, imagine falling asleep at an AA meeting and not paying. And I went up to Walter after. I said, oh, God, Walter, fell asleep in the meeting. He says, isn't that great? And he said, you felt so relaxed here that you could go to sleep. You know, he always did that thing. And I remember, you know, he was another one of the guys that would open his door, you know, because when I got... sober, you know, I had nothing around me. I had a couple of carrier bags. There was, you know, the names that people have, you know, son, brother, colleague, friend, whatever. I had none of those names. There was nothing that I belonged to in this life, you know. If I had a bit of money, I could hang out with some people who drank and did drugs like I did. But as soon as that money ran out, I didn't have that belonging anymore. And the money always ran out awful quick. And I remember going up to Walter's, you know, for a cup of tea. You know, just sitting in the company of a sober man and just talking about stuff and feeling that love and just without condition was just a healing thing. It gave me something to do in the times when I wasn't at meetings, you know. And I remember my first couple of weekends because, the you know, I was working, so during the week I could, you know, be busy and get to a meeting. And, you know, I remember... You know, I remember one Tuesday, I think it was a Tuesday night meeting. Woodley Pat always brought her own cup to the meetings, and she would take it into the kitchen and watch it. And I was angry, Miles, that day, you know, just. So I said, hey, Pat, how come you never do any washing up? Is after a number of time in recovery, you don't have to do any washing up? Is that? And she just laughed at me and went, I've washed up plenty, sweetheart, and what's on? She, you know, she was having none of it. She didn't really care. And, but at the weekends were awful times because there was all this space. And there was a chap around by the name of Army Tom, who, guess what, he used to be in the army. And we have such names for people, you know what I mean? It's like, I'll not tell you what Bernie's name for me used to be because this is being recorded. there was a bet being held. Anyway, he took me back to his place for lunch, you know. And then he took me around Reading. And Reading is a fascinating town if you know the history to it. Like, it's very easy just to see it as a train station and a shopping opportunity. But it used to be the seat of the Chancellor of the Exchequer under the King. And it was just... And he kept me company. And then some more people started to sort of show up in my life. There's a chap the name of Simon turned up, not too dissimilar in age to me, because I felt, you know, I was 29, but I felt like 14. I kept referring to myself as a young person in AA, you know, 29's not that young, really. And so we shared a lot of interests, and another guy by the name of Jeff came along, and we became like the Three Musketeers, you know. We were to be seen everywhere, doing everything. And it enabled me to take my life outside of meetings. So I was hanging out with people who had got the same passion for recovery. We didn't know our ass from a hole in the ground, but we all wanted to get well. We were super keen about this. Didn't know what it was, but we really wanted it. And then the Southern Annual Convention used to be held down at Camber Sands. So everybody was heading for there, you know, and I'm about 5 months in. And so this is what we do. Let's go to this thing. And there was sort of like, there was four of us headed off down there together in a car, and we had about a year between us. You know, it was crazy. The energy, the kind of, it was just unbelievable. And you arrive in a convention center with 2,000 recovering alcoholics, and it just blows your mind, you know. And there's people like Pentonville Johnny and Black Tom and Ironing Board Arthur, you know, well, fabulous guy he was, sharing at the top table, and it was just sparkly, you know. It was just, the energy was phenomenal. And Mick was over, he was in the Sunday meeting, sharing at the top table. And after that meeting ended, and you're just so pumped up, and Barry the dentist, who we mentioned in the roll call, was walking back across the hall, and I said, "Hey Barry, wasn't it great seeing Mick up there?" And you know, alcoholics always have an answer for everything. Said, "It'd be great seeing you up there," you know, boom, like that. And Barry always had that kind of turn of phrase to get going. I came back and it was on. And then what we used to say back then is, if you've been off to a convention in its early days, get to a meeting that evening just to ground yourself, you know. And that's what we're doing. And I was just following the instructions as led out by people, and I was thinking about, when am I going to stop going to meetings, because this year might go on a bit. And again, it was something that Mick had been said to him, because Mick passed on to me what was passed on to him. It was very little, really, but you know, I took what I could. And he had been told, he'd be going to meetings all the time, and someone said, "Mick, have you a life to live? Do you have a family that need your time as well?" So I knew that somebody in AA would, you know, I don't need to think about much. All I need to do is turn up and do this stuff, and it will work. And I talked about a greater than 3-in-1 chance of success. And that Bill had said that the only word that he was uncomfortable with was, "Rarely have we seen a person fail," because in his experience, never. But because you can't say never, you have to put in a word like rarely. So I started putting my hand up for other service positions within AA. And I remember getting to my first share at 3 months, and I was very nervous because I'd been asked to share a couple of times, and I got drunk before them both. You know, so I had a fun, no, I'm saying, sorry, I can't do a chair. So this first chair was a big hurdle for me. You know, I was actually going to share at an AA meeting, and I got past that and felt great. I made the Monday night step meeting, as it was back then, which is in the church off the Oxford Road. I made that my home group because, you know, I understood that this is what this stuff's about. And if a step meeting's my home group, every week I'm looking at a step, and I'm going to be working through it and working through it. And it was just phenomenal, you know, to become part of a group, you know. And we used to come, I used to sit around a big circle, and every so often the church would be singing evangelical songs next door, so that would give a nice backing track to the meeting. And finally, it became my time to be put my hand up to be secretary at the meeting. And I've arrived now, haven't I? I'm going to say, this is my meeting. And I knew exactly what it was going to be and how good this meeting was going to become. It had been good. It was going to become great now. And I had the first 12 people lined up to do shares with. And 3 of them couldn't do the ninth that I thought they should do, because they'll do a great step 3. They'll do a great 5. They'll do... And they couldn't do... I was infuriated. Had to rejig it all. 2 of them drank. It was just terrible. Anyway, I turned up this night for the meeting and had forgotten the key. So I went, I had to go up and find the church to get the key to bring it back down. So I went from being the person who was going to make the Monday night meeting the greatest meeting in the world, most probably, to the person who's most probably going to have it closed. You know, so one of the things that was started to be a tradition in Reading back then was going out for a meal after the meeting on a Friday and Saturday night. I don't know if we still do this kind of thing around here, but there used to be anywhere between about 6 and about 12 of us would head out for a meeting, you know. So, you know, half of my recovery's got to be down to the restaurants in Reading and sitting around talking about stuff outside of the meeting with people, because I think the socialise in AA brought me amazing benefits, you know. I remember sort of the people sitting around the table, and You know, a lot of them are dead, you know, and some of them have disappeared. Jeff, the guy I mentioned earlier, you know, I think of him often, you know. We used to share a house together. But, you know, the decision to pick up that drink rather than, or the, you know, not having the ability to take it to that next place, whatever, took him off on a really destructive journey, you know. And I just hope he's got sober somewhere and everything's going fine. Again, there's a bit of me that doubts it, because you think if you did, you'd get in touch, you know, be part of the process. And there was BBC Paul, there was Tips Litter Tony, worked for 3M. And of course, we don't know how, especially blokes, we're not good at talking about how we feel in our career. So we talk about cars and football and stuff like that. And Tony would talk, and I remember he did his first chair, and 45% of it was talking about his work and about the technical aspects of these tip sealing machines that make tips for 3M. And Andrew, young Andrew, he was just the most beautiful young man, and he was so talented in many, many ways. You know, DF118s and vodka, you know, and dead. And I remember going to his funeral, a few of us went along, and, you know, there was half a dozen people from the fellowship, four members of his family, and a vicar making up stories about his life, and just the anger and the sorrow that was in that room from the family that was there. And then you compare that to, you know, when you go to an AA funeral. Remember, we went over to Barry's funeral, and it was just, I mean, unbelievable. It was like the biggest church in the area, because they knew there'd be a few people turning up. He has a home back in Ireland, and the priest from his parish in Ireland came over to co-officiate at it, asked if he could. And another priest from another part of England, who was his parish priest when Barry first came over, asked to come down, and the two of them co-officiated it. And it was just jammed full of people. And, you know, when people read eulogies, you know, there's often a lot of padding goes on. There wasn't enough time to talk about all of this man achieved. You know, a sober life lived, you know, the wing built in the hospital, you know, it's on and on and on, the kind of stuff it did. You know, the contrast between going to the funeral of somebody who dies drinking and somebody who dies sober is just stunning, you know. It was just absolutely unbelievable. One of the things that I found for me in my own recovery was that in the early days, before I got work, I would, you know, there's a couple of lunchtime meetings on, and the one that was during the week, I think it was a Thursday, you'd get a few retired folk would go for coffee at, what do you call it, the Ramada Hotel, is it? The bottom of the Oxford Road. But anyway, whatever it's called. They used to go in there and have coffees and stuff like that, and they used to let me come with them. He had some company. They would just give me some love and just sit there talking about stuff with people in a non-mad environment. But, you know, after I'm sober a little bit of time, you know, I'm now too cool to hang out with old people like that. And I'm starting to have issues with the language in the big book. You know, it's outdated. It needs rewriting. And I spent an awful lot of my time just charging around, chasing cash and money and trying to make the outside of my world better, because the inside was still far from recovered, you know. But I'd been told, stick around, you know, don't stop going to meetings, because, you know, the people who go to meetings are the ones who are staying sober. So that was drilled into me. And there's a wonderful American expression. It's alligator mouth and hummingbird ass. It's not so much biting off more than you can chew, it's biting off more than you can poo. And that summed me up, really. You know, I was taking big bites of life, with a complete inability to deal with it, you know. I misunderstood the difference between potential and capacity. I thought they were the same thing. I thought because I can think how to do this, I can do it. I didn't know you had to learn how to do stuff. And I was about 3 years in recovery, and I decided, it was 2.5 years or something. I said, I think I'll go off to Australia for a while. I didn't think I was doing a geographical. I just wanted to go to Australia, and I knew what I was doing over here was bullshit. You know, I was so much more dangerous in the early days of sobriety than I was during my drinking. Because during my drinking, everybody knew not to have to stay away. He's a nut job. I didn't put on a reasonable facsimile of a human being. It was just a liability. But sober, you can kind of hold a conversation and turn up the next day and have the next one. And people go, that seems like a good idea. Let's invest in this person. So I decided to head off to Australia. And one of the things that had been drummed into me by that fella down there was, if you move, get a home group and get a sponsor. I think he was just trying to get rid of me, really. Can't say I blame the other fella. But I think in Australian terms, he didn't want me phoning him up in the middle of the night crying down the phone. Because I did cry down the phone. You know, I remember the first time my heart was broken. My world was over. I was never going to love again. You know, I'm 16. I'm in recovery. Well, coming up for 30. I might have been 30, actually. But, you know, inside, this is my heart's broken for the first time, you know. So I phoned Mike up at 10:30 at night. Mike, it hurts. He said, come on over. So I went over and talked for a couple of hours. And Sylvie made tea. And, yeah. And there was, I think it was the Oxford Mini Convention the next day. And he said, come over with me. Understood the importance of just being with someone where it's safe. And in between tears, I helped put up lights and stuff like that. And I'd got this big polar bear, you know, about this size. And it's a wonderful thing. You know, teddy bears are great things for guys to get in recovery, really. Because this thing, when you do that, it just hugs you. Aww. It's just a lovely thing. So, and I brought it to the mini convention. Me and somebody's kid was making off with it. And I'm running across this convention hall shouting at a five-year-old to give me back my teddy bear. You know, just, you know, I was getting in touch with my feminine side. God, that was great. And out in Australia, you know, I got myself a sponsor there and I went to meetings. And I can see how it's very easy to float away from AA when you move to a different, because they do it a bit different, you know. And we're so neurotic, you know. We demand repetition similar, absolutely the same. And I got stuck buying into the program again because I found myself at that emotional rock bottom, you know. And Max, one of the guys out there, was just, he was my sponsor out there, and he just took me through and said, congratulations, Miles, you've got the second half of the first step. 3 years, you know, if I felt so low, I wanted to, you know, please, step 8 or something, give me some credit. He was right, you know, because what AA had done, and the people in Reading just held me, they put up with my bullshit for 3 years while I learned how to walk as a human being. Because when I look back in my life, it was just chaos and drink. What time am I meant to talk to? Is it 2 this afternoon?
till quarter past. You're okay, you've got a long time.
Okay, I've got to talk
you've got
for
enough
another.
Time, I think. I'll double check, keep going.
Okay, write it out. Yes. So the people in Reading held me while I learned how to be Miles and learned out what Miles was about. Because when I look back in my life, because of all that, I didn't know whether, you know, this was just a drink, or whether it was me, or whether it was the circumstances, or what. You know, and my first step forward was a fearful immoral inventory. In fact, when I shared it over at Mick's place, I was expecting him to throw me out of the house. He nearly fell asleep. It was very dramatic in my head, but you know. So I got back into all of that kind of stuff again, and I was out in Australia for about 6 months, and 3 months of those was living in a subtropical rainforest. It was just immense, you know. The things we get to do in recovery, you know. Because all of my life, during the drink, I've been sitting in a bar, you know, fantasizing about stuff and how I was going to this, that, and the other. And nothing ever happened. Because a drink always was part of how you got there. And as soon as I had that first one, geez, here we go. So I bowled back down to Reading because it's where I knew and it's where my AA was. And I was living over in Caversham at this time. I used to live down near the river, you know, because in early recovery I was making good money. And they say that when you stop drinking, it leaves a hole and you can fill it with God or things if things don't work. Well, I tried, you know. GT turbos, beautiful girlfriends, exotic holidays, lots of clothes, eating everywhere, West End shows. Didn't fill the hole. So I'm back in Reading now, and I've moved from, you know, because the kind of counting swans on the Thames while eating croissants and Morello cherry just seemed rather splendid, but it was just facade, it was fake, it was nothing. And then I was staying in a house up in Duncan Hill. And I'm back to the meetings we went again. Already by that time, and I'm only 3 years in, already by that time, a lot of the people who I'd come around the meetings with were starting to disappear, you know. And it's something between 94 and 97% of alcoholics die drunk. So although if you do this stuff, there's better than 3-in-1 chance of you making it. The overall figure for success is about 1 in 35. You know, it's. I think kamikaze pilots during the Second World War had a higher success rate than your average alcoholic. It's really frightening. You know, and you talked about a taxi driver. Was it Gary? Yeah, you know. And, you know, the number of people who turned up and people who were found cold with empty bottles beside them. And people who you'd sat beside in meetings, and people you'd sat beside in restaurants and cracked jokes with, you know, no longer with us. And the film The Dam Busters, you know, there's that kind of morning breakfast after the raid where you see some of the tables are empty because those crews haven't come back. And that's what AA feels a lot like to me, you know. In a lot of the meetings, it's the people who are not there, you know. And you do kind of, you know, I remember Jeff, I got a flat with her. He wasn't earning any kind of, like, decent money, so I got a flat with a nice second bedroom he was going to share with me. You know. We've all done stuff to try and help people in AA, you know, do the garage up, move them in, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, all we can really do, and all the sober people ever did with me, you know, the people who had some time, was to stand beside me and take me through bit after bit of, bit of the program. My health, at about 5 years, took a serious dip. I didn't know why. It was never explained to me by the doctors who I went to see, although I was telling them what I was feeling, and what it was my thyroid was out. And for between 12 and 14 years, it continued to degenerate quite profoundly to the extent that I was in very poor shape altogether. I did suggest to a doctor that they check my thyroid function. They did, and so I got on the medication as a result of that. And, you know, when I look at people with self-worth and how people with self-worth treat themselves, you know, something's wrong, they go do something about it. It's that old thing, you know, in the airline it says, if the oxygen mask drops down, make sure you put your own on first. You know, I found that I'd spent a lot of time in recovery because, you know, I didn't stop drinking and become perfect. I thought I would. But all of that stuff was still there to be dealt with. And, you know, if all of the things in your life that are important to you in terms of services, whether it's medical or whatever, all begin with a letter A, you know, the first thing you come to in Yellow Pages. For any young people, Yellow Pages was a big book we used to look at to find phone numbers. So, when I was about 6 years sober, I met this remarkable woman named Debbie, and she was just, she took my breath away. In every sense of the word. And when I got to know her as a person, it was even more profound, you know. So after about 10 years, you know, we're having a great life. You know, this, you know, the adventures that you can have in recovery, you know, are just, you know, incredible. You can do whatever you like. And I believe that because, you know, there were people around who had energy and who were looking for stuff to happen in recovery when I came around, you know. They weren't about hiding under the rock of alcohol, as I've been saying. I'm an alcoholic, I'm not drinking, I can't do anything else, that's it. They were going, to hell with this, let's get out and live. And they lit me up, you know. And so, and I remember at about 3 months, I'm on my knees praying for, you know, to a God I know not. Most of my life I would describe myself as a optimistic agnostic. Really? I hope there's someone there. But I, you know, and I'd spent time in monasteries and it really up and down throughout my life. You know, there was always an aspect of Miles that was seeking something. But my prayers when I first came to AA were the first three steps because I believed in those. They were real. All the other words in prayers were just words. They were empty. But, you know, I was saying who I was and what I was about. And back then, people used to talk about a little black book, which is a little 24-hour daily devotional thing, and they used to say, read from that. So I used to read from that. And there used to be, you know, Share magazine, read from that. So read from that. And there was a, you know, back then, there used to be a thing called Loners International Meetings by Mail, pre-internet. So if you couldn't get to a meeting, you were stuck. And so they had this thing called Loners, and people would write to each other. It was lovely. And there was one particular guy who was a paraplegic, lived in the middle of nowhere in Canada, and I used to write to him, and we would share back and forth, and it was a wonderful thing.
Oh, I like that.
And I kept a journal at the end of each day, which is a kind of part of the step five stuff, is about reflecting on your day. And in the morning, I would start off with the prayers, and I would read my Just for the Day card again. You know, phenomenal. The content in that Just for the Day card. If you just do that, you're home. And I had this routine, and there would be a meeting into the day, you know, and my life was just changing so dramatically. And I remember praying and thinking, the kind of image of God I had in my head was the kind of one from my childhood. It was a grey-bearded fella on a chair with a big book of what I'd done wrong. and it wasn't going to be a good, and it was a kind of a fearful, and it was an unpleasant thing, because I reckon if I met this God was going to do for me. Yeah. So a lot of the time, there used to be, you know, these AA tapes we used to have, and Jack Brennan was one of the ones a lot of people used to listen to back then, and one called Father Martin, who he didn't particularly appeal, but there was a woman who used to go to the meetings over in Maidenhead called Inge, and she had just come over from Germany, and on the forces base there, in the meetings there, she'd got a tape from a guy called Bob Earl. And Bob Earl has a different way of looking at things, and she let me have this tape because she heard me talking about this conflict, this dilemma, and Bob, this was a talk he was doing called What Does God Look Like? And it was incredible, you know, if you want to, it sort of ends up, if you want to see God, look at the person beside you. You know, you will find God in them as that love transmits itself to you. But there's a flip side to that, because it has to be in you too, you know. So that took me off, you know, because I knew even right at the early days that, you know, yes, this is not a religious program, but it is a spiritual program. And although I was still slightly confused about what was what, you know, and there would be a lot of people sharing around the meetings what their kind of idea of spirituality and what their particular journeys were on. So, you know, I'm listening to Bob, and that starts me off. And I remember going to a Buddhist meeting up the road here, and a wonderful guy, an American who had come across Buddhism, is doing overseas voluntary work and studied for many years. And I would go to Quaker meetings, and I loved Quaker meetings, just sit in contemplative silence and listen to that. And I was exploring everywhere, and there was a lot of New Age stuff going about, some of which was fanciful. And there was a lot of people getting into sort of kind of pantheism and sort of Native American stuff. And, you know, and I couldn't, you know, I didn't have a image inside of me of what God looked like or what particular form of devotion to follow. But I was genuinely looking, you know, and I knew that if I pretended, that one day that pretense would come back and kill me, and that this needed to be real. So I couldn't sit at a meeting and go, you know, this is who God is, and this is how wonderful he is in my life, and could you lend me your tambourine, please? But I was on that journey, you know, and when we look at step 11, and sought through prayer and meditation, it's to seek, you know, and I was seeking most genuinely, and there was a lot of people around who shared their stuff with me, and would give me other books, and this kind of underground goes on in AA. Back in the day, there, whenever you had a mini convention, there would always be a discussion about the literature table, about whether Hazeldene literature should be on the same table as AA literature, and this would form, you know, one of the gunfights at Thames Valley Intergroup meeting. And I remember one year they decided that they were going to have a once and for all meeting on it. You can't have a future. We're making this law up for now, which of course was sort of laughed out. You know, it's just something that we do, and you know, usually it would end up with some kind of compromise. We'll have a table and make it clear that the two are separate. But there was an underground thing going on. You know, it's like if you want to see the seekers, look around you. They're here in this room today, and you would get people would come up and they would give you little books that they'd found helpful and that they'd found inspiring. You know, and the literature tells us to do that. You know, find who you can. And if you haven't got a strong connection with a priest or a vicar or a rabbi or an imam or, you know, a Roshi or whoever takes you on your way, then, you know, you find it by exploring with other people. And my friend Simon, I used to sort of listen to people like Tim Wheater, who used to do sort of like flute music and stuff like that. He used to take the piss out of me something terrible. He used to say, God, you've got the elevator music on again, you know, it's like, So he was, a lot of humour. There was also a lot of pain and a lot of drama and a lot of suffering that goes on in early recovery, you know, and a lot of controversy and conflict, and, you know, it's very easy to lose fellowship in the midst of ego. You know, and I think that's one of the things that AA does really good, is it hangs on to that kind of fellowship thing. And then I remember I met this earlier figure of beauty I was Friday night, I was going to go off to the meeting, I just got back from work, had a shower, just drying off, and I'm thinking, this is fabulous, you know, that kind of lit recovery stuff, oh, after AA, I love it, but I'm feeling a little bit lonely, you know, and the higher power being the higher power, and generally wonderful, sent this figure of beauty to the meeting, who I had to invite for pizza afterwards. It would be unkind of me not to. And we got into a relationship, and I remember going to see Mick, because this is real early days, you know, and all the kind of stuff around the meetings was, you know, there's a slip under every skirt, you know. So, you know, we won't talk about sexism in the rooms, but hey, so, and I don't often wear a skirt. And so I know I'm going to have to share this with Mick. I'm going to have to talk about having met someone and gotten a relationship. And then it double jeopardy because she's in the fellowship. Oh, God. So I'm still banned from driving. Mick's picking me up. He's taking me to the Wantage meeting. So I go, oh, Mick, how do you do it, man? So we get in the car and we're driving off to the Wantage meeting. And there doesn't seem to be a suitable pause in the conversation because, you know, he's a gabby son. He never stops talking. So it's very hard to get a word in edgewise. And we got to the meeting and all Mick's fans ran up to him and started cuddling him and wanting to talk to him. So I was left off the side, the newbie, got nothing to say to anyone. So I can't talk to him at the meeting because there's too many people. And not that I'm resentful here. Yeah, 30 years, still hanging on to it. Anyway, we're in the car, we're on the way home. And again, the conversation doesn't seem to lead itself to broaching the subject of this newfound person who, you know, I'd fallen in lust with. And we pull up to where I'm staying, and I've got one hand on the door handle for a quick getaway, seatbelts undone. And I say, oh, Mick, I met someone. He goes, oh, that's interesting. Yes. I said, it's some of the fellowship. And you could see him slump in the chair. Oh, God. He said, Miles, he said, you know, in my experience, one or other ends up, sometimes both end up drinking. And I thought, I'm going to have to get a new sponsor. Because she's pretty and smells nice and is awful cuddly. And he's just Mick. You know, all he can do is save my life. And then he said, hang on, I'm telling you lies, you know. And that's one of the things that I just, you know, love is the ability for someone to pause and not let their ego get in the way. He said, I know a lot of people who have, you know, and he was being clever too, because, you know, he knew I'm hanging off the edge of the cliff. he said, you know, I know a lot of people who have successful relationships. He said, but, you know, keep your AA separate, treat each other with kindness, you know, and put your recovery first. You'll be all right if you do that. Yeah, and we did do that, both of us. And, you know, you have to learn how to have relationships. You know, when you're young, free, and frustrated in AA, you know, and somebody 60 years of age telling you that you don't need to bother with relationships for a couple of years, go smoke a pipe. You know, it's just, it's just not going to happen. You know, it's just... And learning how to be a human. Like, my first dates in AA were with women who were friends of mine, one who was in AA and one who wasn't, because I didn't know how to do anything without being... wired on something or other, you know, to actually sit down and have a conversation over nice food and about nothing was just, you know, it's a skill, it's an art, you have to learn it. So, you know, we're charging around here, getting well, and there's a lot of collateral damage, but there's a lot of collateral damage in life. You can't get sober in a vacuum, you have to get sober in the real world, otherwise you've got nothing to live with, you know. And I remember Simon, he had got a girlfriend, he'd gone off on holiday, taken Jeff off on holiday. And remember, Bernie wanted to take Jeff off on holiday once, but Mary wouldn't let him. And Bernie probably remembers where you were going to take him. And he was a bit obsessive about certain stuff. Anyway, Simon took Jeff off on holiday, and this German girl had let Simon know that she kind of liked him. And Simon's thinking, no, I'm in a relationship, I just mustn't know, I'm in a relationship, I won't. So he didn't. And he came home, and shortly after he came home, because he was doing a course at the Open University, he went off to a residential at the Open University. Anyway, 2 a.m, the phone starts ringing. I'm like, oh, Jesus, what's this? Because normally when the phone rings at 2 a.m, it's usually somebody feeling a little bit tired and emotional, who didn't hear that bit which says, don't ring after you've had a drink. And it's amazing how long it takes to get a drunk off the phone when you say, I'm not going to talk to you, call you tomorrow. It takes half an hour just to end the conversation. And it was Simon. And he's in distress. And I'm thinking, Simon, slow down, what's wrong? And well, it turns out he met a girl at the Open University thing, and they'd got it on, and he's feeling really bad. And we talked for maybe 45 minutes about, you know, the kind of moral dilemma he was in. And in good AA fashion, it turned up his big regret was that he hadn't said yes to the German as well, because he might as well have while he was away. You know, so learning how to live, learning how to pay bills, learning how to do stuff. The guys in Reading just held me. They took me places. They showed me stuff. They loved me. We had the most immense amount of fun. Ironing Board Arthur, who you heard me talk about earlier. Ironing Board Arthur, for those that don't know, got his name from his first share. He was he'd been in a home for the bewildered, and part of the rehabilitation was that you have to learn to make these ironing boards out of pressing. So you just stamp stuff, plug it all together. Cause it's just, you know, like making number plates or basket weaving. It's that kind of thing. An ironing board, Arthur was a big old unit. He was a big fella. You know, in his day, he would have been frightening. You know, I mean, he was the kind of guy who comes through a door rather than actually opens it. So he had been around the meetings for about 18 months, 2 years, and nobody had ever asked him to share because he was quite rattly and shaky and scary and mad. So this meeting, he stood up at the front. He said, "I'm going to do the share tonight." And everyone went, "Okay." And then he realized that he didn't know what to say. So he just talked about how you make an ironing board for half an hour. He told me how, hence the super ironing board, Arthur. You know, and I was talking to Tom on the way across about, you know, how people will go into a meeting and they'll just hear somebody say something amusing or witty and insightful and say, "Oh, come and do a chair," you know, and the person turns up and haven't stopped drinking and it's just something they read in the back of a packet of crisps. Because, you know, what I was taught is you learn, you hear the chair, you bring to your group what you would wish your group to have, you know. So if you're bringing something that is as beautiful as you can make it, if you have taken care about the people that you're inviting into your group, it's not an ego thing, it's just a, you know, it's a compassion, you know, because wisdom is made manifest by compassion. You put that effort in to find people who can bring some recovery into your group, a different aspect on it. So we drove up to London one night to get Arthur to bring him back, and he came back and shared meetings with us. And there was a chap around as well called Wick. Mick most probably remembers Wick, and maybe Bernie remembers Wick as well. You know, he was the first AA in the UK, Wick, and he got sober in New York. And we were at a meeting over in Marlow, and down below, the hall down below, there was a judo class, or a karate or something like that, and you would go, "Shaw!" And in that moment, silence, to remember why we are here, when that finished, Wick said, "That's a familiar sound," because all you hear just sound like people throwing up downstairs, you know. And the light in people's eyes and you know, all of these events that we run, take a look at the people who turn up, you know, the ones who turn up for the celebrations and for the special events, they want it. They're hungry. It's not, you know, they're putting the effort in, you know. If you want to understand motivation, look at action, you know. On my journey towards my relationship with my higher power, I remember I was about 18 years ago now, I realized that for me, there wasn't a God figure that made any sense to me. And I realized that I wasn't an agnostic, that I was actually an atheist. And this kind of caused a lot of internal energy to start flowing in me because, you know, it's crap. I'm an alcoholic in recovery. I need a higher power. You know, what's going on? It felt to be very unsettling. And it's certainly, you don't hear a lot of people talking about it at meetings, about not believing in God. And so, you know, who's going to be my pathfinder in this? You know, there's a wonderful woman named Mara Hornbacker, and recovering alcoholic addict, bipolar, bipolar eating disorder, like, you know, out of the most damaged people come the greatest jewels, you know, because to live you have to find the gold, you know, you can't not. And she helped me understand the program from a perspective of that. And actually, if you take a look at religions like Buddhism doesn't actually hold the concept of God. It's a process of being. And step 11 at that point, isn't it funny? That's the point at where step 11 really became critical and crucial for me. That's when meditation really started to become a major part in my life. You know, and again, you know, all around me, all of the time in AA, there are people who are walking these things, and you're talking about stuff at a meeting. If you share where you're at, someone will hear you and come up to you and go, "Here." You know, and people came up here all the time, you know. And, you know, I remember there's Michael Kevin, you talked about it. Michael, when he came over from Ireland to England, he he's talking to Cher about. We saw Free House written on pubs. Now, in Ireland, all pubs are owned. They're not owned by the breweries, they're owned by the landlords. So he was just stunned, because all the stories that he had heard about England being a land of plenty. So he went and he got himself a Guinness and a large whiskey, and the man asked him for some money. And Mick thought he was trying to con him. Michael thought he was trying to con him, because that's a free house, and the guy had to explain to him about that, what it was about. But I remember, you know, Michael, you know, he would do anything for AA. He would go anywhere to help anyone at any time, you know. And, you know, I just finish with, you know, there's this lovely thing. When anyone anywhere reaches out the hand for help, I am responsible. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Miles. Wow, that was... It's these days are so special, hearing stories like yours, and it you know, you talked a lot about the energy and the fellowship, and that was brilliant, because it just listening to you, especially the early days, isn't it? It's all about the energy and
courage.
That wonderful, zestful life, and I just love hearing stories about the old timers and how they helped, and Bernard and Mick, and just trying to keep a straight face through it. He was.
He is now. He's just miserable.
He's
not an act, he is miserable.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, that was absolutely fabulous. Thank you very much. And I think now.